You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Is now an industrial. Then we went through industrial revolution where child labor was common. We look at that now as exploitive. Child labor in many parts of the world is the only source of income that keeps the whole family from starvation. So at a certain point it's a virtue. Then evolution moves on and no longer it's a virtue. So you understand everything is contextualized based on the evolution of consciousness as it expresses itself in that area and that region at that time. But always the more advanced tend to exploit the less advanced.
So what's the meaning of the term advanced? Exploitation?
More intelligent, more educated, more capable, quicker to make a buck. We're out there to make a buck. We send all our work out and out to China, right? That's the intellect saying, what should we do? Pay $10 an hour, we can get it done for $4 an hour?
So, is this measurement of intellect?
Well, you can look at it. You see, you're going to project values onto it now. Is it exploitive or beneficial?
It depends on.
Should we have emergency surgeons working at the machines at $10 an hour? Now the populace has to pay more money for a shirt. I can send it out and get it done for $3 an hour. Now everybody can afford a shirt. So what is beneficial and what is not beneficial? What is exploitive? Is alimentation, which you then project into the world. It's none of those things. The evolution of consciousness is when a country gets industrialized, child labor comes out while it was first. Now explain the children, see? The child is the only source of food the whole family has. You want to get rid of child labor, you want the whole family to die of starvation now when they were the only source of income, you understand? So things only can be understood in terms of the context, the social reality of the time. Not in some abstract moralistic positionality. Okay.
So things like
today's exploited is tomorrow's exploiter. I'll tell you that.
Okay, I understand.
The poor man of today is the rich man of tomorrow, and exploits the other poor man of the day after that. See, so we all take our turns in these various roles.
Okay. I'm trying specifically to understand. Different groups that have had experiences. So Africans in slavery, Native American people in genocide and that kind of thing. So I'm trying to see how this...
Yeah, I understand what you're struggling with.
Okay.
You see, in the times of Genghis Khan, in the time of the Vikings, they didn't take captives. They slaughtered everybody. Mm-hmm. Then they discovered that people were of value and could be sold. So slavery was really an advancement over being slaughtered. You had your choice between being completely slaughtered or saved because now you're a commodity. So in the west of Africa, human beings were a commodity. That was prevalent throughout the entire world. It wasn't limited to West Africa. In fact, it still exists in the Middle East and various Arabic countries. Slavery is still practiced. So
The Greeks.
Yes, anyway, slavery was part of life, you see. And there were various castes, of which the slave was one caste. And at the time of ancient Rome, the slaves outnumbered the citizens by 10 to 1. And the great astronomers, scientists, the people that the Caesar relied on were all actually by caste slaves. You know? All his great astronomers and scientists were actually slaves. So it's like each one of us, as consciousness evolves, takes turns being master and slave, being exploiter, exploited. I myself remember being chained to the oars of a slave ship. I myself remember vividly and exquisitely the exact details of the entire experience. I also remember that the pain and suffering reached a point of non-tolerance. Became enraged at me and extremely savage. Not only was it brutal, but on that ship there was no sanitary facilities. Everybody defecated and urinated right where they sat at the oars. And I can remember at the point of breaking that I couldn't tolerate anymore, I suddenly realized I was not a prisoner, that I could die. And I suddenly let the body go and went out of body, and I realized I can never be imprisoned. That which I am is free. and I validated my spiritual reality, and I found freedom through death. Huh? So I defeated the son of a bitch. I died on him. Screw you. And found my own freedom through spiritual reality. And that was the purpose of that death, was to discover that my reality is my spirit and not my body. And they can capture my body, but they cannot capture my spirit. And that's what keeps the blacks so brilliantly alive, because they know that their spirit is unconquerable. And they've survived all that slavery and all that crap, and that'll all be part of the past. It adds to their strength and their grandeur now. Anybody can survive good times. Let's see who survives bad times. So the black has proven himself. They have the strength and the power. The blacks are now at the top of everything in our society. Top of entertainment, top of sports, top of TV. The blacks are the top of everything. Get it? Oh, yeah, they are. You better read Fortune magazine. Who's the richest woman in the world right now?
Oprah.
Oprah Winfrey, get up here. She makes more money than the Queen of England.
I just have one simple question about relationship between God, light, and love.
God, light, and love. Those are different terminologies, you know?
I see it as God sending love to us on a carrier beam, external, physical, and soulful.
Oh, that's a conceptualization, you see? It's mixing description with reality. It's mixing talking about with being. That which is the infinite presence is what it is. And then any qualities ascribed are human derivations and descriptions, whether it's light, love, presence, or love, are only humanizations. You know, when the presence is there, there is no word you can describe it. If you have a near-death experience, what are you going to say to people later? You have to manufacture words that are the closest to the human experience, because there's nothing like it. Nothing like it. There's no way to describe it.
Thank you.
Hi.
Yeah.
This is my name, and this is your dissertation that I bought, so may I have that signed, please?
Here you go.
I went through whatever the dissertation thing is.
Yeah, speak up.
Maybe she doesn't want it. Do you want this?
No. What?
Well, yeah, if anybody else wants
to
buy it. Where did I buy it? It's a place where you go to buy dissertations. There's a telephone number and all that stuff. Anyway, I bought his dissertation. So.
Very good for you.
Thank you.
And be sure and read it.
Oh, well, right, yeah, I have. Anyway. May I please ask about avatar? Do you have, what's your definition of avatar?
Avatar, what's your definition of avatar?
Yes, it's a traditional term, meaning the great founder of a great religion who transforms the consciousness of mankind through millennia. Like Jesus, this year is called 2003. 2003 what? 2003 after the birth of Jesus Christ. So the avatar sets down through the centuries the paradigm out of which we construct what is acceptable, what is moral, what is ethical, and sets the paradigm of virtue, integrity, and spirituality for thousands of years. After 1,000 years, the consciousness of mankind is still dominated by Buddha, Krishna, Jesus Christ, and Muhammad.
And I'm using this in my dissertation also.
Good for you.
As a resource.
Hello. What's the best way to phrase a question you want to ask and get an answer from for kinesiology?
You make a statement. See, with kinesiology, you'll notice I always make a statement. I say, this calibrates over 200, this calibrates over 300, and then I push down quickly. The kinesiologic response is very brief. It's a matter of seconds.
Oh, yeah.
So I say, as I say, she doesn't need to know what I'm holding in mind. I'll say, what I'm holding in mind is true. And then I push. I push with maybe 4 or 5 ounces, you see, and she pushes back. Mm-hmm. So with practice, the other person, it becomes quite intuitive after a while. So I'll say, what I'm holding in mind is true, and already she feels the energy go down her arm before even the muscles even react. Now the action is very quick. So when you have to press down quickly. The reason is the monkey falling out of the tree, primitive animal in us, when your arm goes weak, it feels it's falling out of a tree, and it tries to strengthen it again. When we were in Korea, the biggest problem we had is everybody was getting false positives, you know. And it's because they would resist, just as their arm would go down. Men tend to do it more than women. They would resist as though they're trying to prove how strong they are as a strong man. No, it's sensitivity. And in response to one question, you'll feel a differential between the weakness and the strength. And is that you can feel it as an energy running down your arm. You already know the answer. So when I ask her a question, she already has the answer. In fact, I intuit from her response that my nervous system picks up from her nervous system whether strengths or weaknesses. That just comes from doing it with the same person all the time.
Do you have to ask permission of them?
I ask permission in front of a crowd. I always ask permission if it's a new piece of information, and I'm not sure whether I have karmic permission to enter there. Occasionally we get a no. Occasionally we get a no.
Oh, I see.
And I don't usually ask why. I just accept that's how. I say, do I have permission to ask this in front of this audience? It says no. Then sometimes, a couple moments later, a different audience, I'll say, do I have permission to ask this question? They'll say yes. Well, this audience is very sophisticated, you know, very, you know, erudite. Let's see what happened with the consciousness of this, people that's here. We have permission to ask this. The consciousness level of this congregation, these people here, went up over 8 points, 9 points, 10 points. Oh, wow, 11 points. 10 points. The consciousness level of this audience went up 10 points as a result of the lecture. Yeah. So just certain information presented from a certain level of consciousness is already transformative. The average human life, the average person's consciousness advances 5 points in a lifetime. And so today, the whole group went up with 10 points all in a matter of hours, you know. How many lifetimes would it take to go up to? You know what you have to go through two lifetimes? Think of all the sore feet you had, teeth extractions, all the shovels of coal.
Do we retain that?
Two lifetimes. No, you retain it, because once you get it, you get it.
Oh, okay.
So, no, it's a permanent jump of 10 points just from being open to hearing the truth. You say, oh, wow. Oh, wow. And you say, wow. Already you're different when you say, oh, wow.
Thank you. I have one second question.
Yes.
You mentioned that we have a predetermined lifetime. You know, when we're going to die is that correct?
The exact time of death, we've asked it many a time, and I'll be glad to ask it again. The exact time of death is preset at the moment of birth. Don't ask me the why of it.
Can through our free will exercise we increase that or shorten
no,
it?
No, no. With the exercise of free will, you can exercise the option, whether you want to hobble there in a wheelchair or you want to do it at a motorcycle at 80 miles an hour. So, I mean, you have some say over the method and the technique and the conditions. But the exact moment is set. You cannot stay here 1 second beyond it, nor can you leave 1 second before. I know people that shot themselves, threw themselves in the river, and took poison all at the same time. They're still alive.
<Thank you. laughs>
Then I had a lady who threw herself in the East River, and they brought her into the psychiatric department. She threw herself in the East River, and she took bichloride of mercury. Bichloride of mercury used to be a favorite poison years ago. She took bichloride of mercury. Well, bichloride of mercury kills you in two ways. One is instantly. Due to a toxic, it'll kill you right away. It has a delayed action where it kills you slowly by knocking out your kidneys. So they dragged this lady out of the East River into the psychiatric department. We put her on antidepressants. I put her on antidepressants. You know what she said? Do these have any side effects? So help me God, that is the truth. She wanted to know, do these have any side effects? All right, so she survived the initial insult of a big dose of bichloride of mercury. And what she didn't know, and which I didn't tell her, is if the fact that she didn't die before means it'll be a matter of 2 weeks, she'll be dying in 2 or 3 weeks, because the kidney failure then set in. So by that time, she changed her mind, decided she didn't want to die. But unfortunately, she had already sealed her fate, and she died of kidney failure a matter of weeks later. So that was a paradoxical case. Drowned herself, take bichloride of mercury, survive it, decide I want to live, and then get taken out of here anyway. And then ask me in the meantime, what about side effects? Oh, the life of a psychiatrist, I'll tell you. 50 years of that. And you wonder why I'm peculiar. Well.
My question is a very simple one.
Yeah.
Where does one go to get trained in your particular method of kinesiology? And the second part of that is it necessary or can you self-teach through the book alone? Or is there a school of teaching this?
No, there isn't a school. What we've done is we've videotaped all the lectures. We've written it all in a series of books, and then we have another one forthcoming. We have all-day conferences, all-day lectures and discussions every 2 months in Sedona. We do an all-day. And then at least once or twice a month, we go around the country and do another all-day. Usually those are all videotaped, so there's a massive information. And a lot of the information just is in and of itself transformational, see? So some of the things we said today, you know, a month from now, you'd be driving along and all of a sudden you go, oh.
Yeah.
Because it takes a while for information to work through the various chakras of the various archetypes in the unconscious. So you may hold the thing intellectually today but not really get it for 3 months because a part of you is, you know, challenged by that or upset by that or it's opposed to what he believes in. So, you know, various archetypes are present in the personality and the collective unconscious as well as your personal unconscious. So what may appeal to one archetype in you may be quite challenging to another. See? Today we're talking quite a bit about the spiritual knight, the solar plexus of the spiritual knight. And, you know, the one who goes out there with the sword and kills for God, you know what I mean? Then you got to move out of the solar plexus now that you've proven your valor and your testosterone has had a great time, and you got to move up to the heart. Well, after the war is over, the veterans of World War II, those of us who are alive, I look at him and I love him, even though he was a German and I know he was trying to kill me, and the Japanese kamikaze was trying to bomb me, but now we care about each other. So we move from the solar plexus to the heart, and we salute that which is honorable in each other, see? So we salute the honor in each other, you understand? So we both have transcended it, see? But that's a lesson. How do you learn that without living through it? You can't exactly read it in a book and get it, because where you get it is in your gut, see? So a lot of times, some people say, well, sometimes your language gets strong. I say, well, did you ever notice half the audience is men? A lot of spiritual workshops is 98% women, and there's this guy looking off in the window, you know, because they're talking about hearts and flowers. So I speak equally to the men as to the women, see? So sometimes I'll say, that's crap. And the guy knows what crap means. That's crap. Oh, I get what you mean, see? That's the mean solar plexus. The lady may find that offensive. She would like different languaging, you know? So I try to speak equally to both sexes. Today I didn't give testosterone the rundown I usually do. I envision the world has been the victim of testosterone for many a century.
So when you said you have to learn very quickly and a few hours, that part of the testing, you don't have a school or a way of...
Oh, no. Kinesiology is taught all over the place. There's classes on it everywhere. It's on the Internet.
Oh, okay.
So it's a very simple, quick technique. It takes you about 3 seconds to learn it.
Okay.
You know. Okay, just hold that chair. No. Okay. I'm holding something in mind. Okay. Now resist.
Okay.
All right.
Should I not be looking? Oh, shut the eye.
All right. I'm holding something in mind. Now resist. Okay. Just resist equally to my pressure. See? I'm pushing down with 3 ounces. You don't have to push back with 1 pound. You understand?
Oh, okay.
I push down with 3 ounces. You push back with 3 ounces. Okay, I'm holding something in mind right now. Resist. Okay, good. All right, I'm holding something in mind right now. Resist. You went weaker.
Okay.
See, first I was holding Abraham Lincoln. Secondly, I was holding Adolf Hitler. Okay. There was a decided difference in the strength.
Yeah.
See, because you don't have that experience with it. Your arm went down, and then you think you're an ape falling out of the tree. You quickly resist gravity. You see what I'm saying? Okay. You tried to counter it.
Yeah.
The thing is, when you feel the weakness, surrender to the weakness, surrender to the weakness, and you'll get an instant answer. So I wasn't telling you what I was holding in mind, you know, because that answers the questions. Are you loading the dice? No, I'm not loading the dice because you don't know what I'm thinking.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for
being wonderful day.
Giving me a chance to explain it. No, we don't calibrate individuals and personalities. Except for a dollar.
I'll go get my purse.
I'll tell you where I got the dollar. I was in Peru, Machu Picchu, and there was this little girl, and she had this llama, you know. Yeah, right now I have llamas, but anyway, so I met the llamas there in Peru, and she's holding this llama, this little bitty girl about this high. And I got a camera. I said, "Can I take your picture?" She said, "That'll be a dollar." So, ever since then, I tell people, "That'll be a dollar."
Tell me about the dog and cat. You didn't tell them what the purr at Calvary 10 and the dog's.
Oh, I forgot the vital information. Gosh almighty.
No.
I forgot the vital information. I was talking about the evolution of consciousness, you see, and how it evolves through the animal kingdom. The interesting thing is that a cat's purr calibrates at 500, and a dog's wagging tail calibrates at 500. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
And that's higher than most of the humans on the planet. You are safer with my kitty than you are with 95% of the people you meet on the subway. And a dog's wagging tail is, you know, the dog just comes up to you and loves everybody. It loves you and loves you. And I met two new kitties this weekend. Friends of mine have two kitties I met before. And the kitties just came up there and just purring and purring and you know, they calibrated 500. So isn't that amazing? How did these two animals escape, you know, and manage to maintain love without a mind? Because their mind really, they don't really have a mental body yet, but they already have a heart. Isn't that interesting? So each one of those things you could see, you know, you could research that whole phenomena for a week. How does that come about, evolutionary-wise, that a dog's wagging tail is 500? And we see 85% of the population on the planet calibrates below 200, never mind 500.
Okay. I have a statement first, and yeah. That is that I would like to really say how much that we appreciate that you have decided to stay at this dimension and help us to grow. And I just think that every time I've read the books, how much I appreciate that. And because I know that it can't be that easy. The other thing is my fiancé and I are going to be married during this convention, and I wondered if you would stand with us.
I don't know if we can stand with you or not. Where are you going to get married?
Well, just we don't know. My sister's here. She's a minister, and we're just going to do it sometime.
If I'm invited to the party, you let me know when the time arrives.
That's it. That's the whole party. It's just us. Definitely.
That was a party, not a funeral, right? And my dollar. All right, for that dollar, I'll be there, yeah.
I just had a question. The informative slides with the levels of consciousness of the countries at present, is that in any of your publications?
That's in a forthcoming book. You know, we calibrated all the countries in the world. You see, you can calibrate the people. You can calibrate the regime. And they don't always coincide. Sometimes the regime is horrible and the people are okay. Sometimes it's the other way. That regime is okay, and the people are horrible anyway.
So that's number four.
So, anyway, we calibrated all the countries in the world. And we also calibrated a couple hundred movies. You know, we're trying to give an understanding to human civilization. And then we go back in history to Caesar and Cicero and Nero. We go back to the ancient philosophers, the spiritual teachings throughout the ages. You know, it's a profound piece of work and staggering, frankly. It's like trying to calibrate the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I say, I don't know if we should have taken this on. I don't know if we should have taken this on.
Well, we'll be waiting for it.
But it reveals, it's like we've known man in black and white two dimension. Now we see man in technicolor in three dimension. And you just get a different feeling. And what happens is a greater compassion for mankind, a greater compassion. You see the tortuous avenues that consciousness has had to evolve and the impairment. I mean, just to have the animal brain within your physical brain. You know what I mean? Somebody steps on your toe. The animal brain says, gee, did it. You know what I mean? And now you say, dear God, I'm sorry that I misused thy name in vain, etc. I mean, man walks a tightrope. I didn't get a chance to explain my understanding. He walks the tightrope between man, between animal and angel, right? On the one hand, he's torn by animal emotions and drives. Testosterone drives him crazy at age 18. And the angelic, because the same testosterone that drives him now fills him with guilt. You know, I was a very religious young fellow. I was an acolyte. I was a soprano in the choir, high Episcopal. I was the bishop's acolyte. And confession in high Episcopal was like Catholic. Confession was Saturday afternoon, and then communion Sunday morning. So I would go to confession as late as possible Saturday afternoon, and communion as early as possible Sunday, to leave the smallest possible gap where a sin could occur. So I go to confession, I confess everything, you know, I was scrupulous. In those days I started from scrupulosity, guilty about everything. Well, sin was a spot on your soul that God could see. So I lived in dread that this spot was going to appear, and you'd go to communion and God would see this spot, and God knows what would happen to you if you did that, see? So on the way to communion one morning in a 29 Model A Ford with the top down, we go past this 40-foot-long billboard, and there's a lady in a Janssen swimming suit. Big yellow swimming suit, 40 feet long. And I'm a 14-year-old boy whose testosterone is going crazy, and I'm trying to keep from sinning. There you live between heaven and hell, you know what I mean? The animal coming up with testosterone, and God on the other side of the billboard frowning down at you, and the seduction of this 40-foot-long lady in a Janssen swimming suit. Nowadays, we would consider her well covered up and pristine and hardly sexually, but in those days.
Thank you.
Yeah. So that's a dilemma of being a human. Therefore, I bless all humans for their effort. Everybody gets a passing grade for effort.
I have a follow-up question.
Everybody gets born here and survives to the end deserves already a C+, a pass.
I have a follow-up question to what he just answered about the world map.
Yes.
That some countries, it was stated that they were 70 and they weren't going anywhere because they didn't have enough energy.
Mm-hmm.
Yet you had some, you know, what would be considered the most terrible people that ever lived, that are caused or put a lot of people to death. They calibrated at 15. Where would they? Is that a calibration of energy, or is that a? How does that work?
I don't know. We calibrate the level of consciousness, and we just tell you what the figure is. Some we have even lower than that. So there's some even lower than that. Serial child killers calibrate probably the lowest of all of them. Okay. Their calibrated level of consciousness is extremely low. Yeah. Don't ask me the why of it. So right now we're just still gathering data. And the significance and understanding of it, you know, may take a couple of generations, a lot of minds working on it, and then it'll all become apparent. But
so it's yeah. Not really an energy issue.
It's just where they are in.
It's where they are if you
in
a comparative way. See, because these, you know, the calibrations are comparative.
Okay. I have another question on the kinesiology, and that is in your first book you had the O, where you could do it on yourself.
Yes.
Is that possible still? Do you recommend that or not recommend
it? I don't recommend it. It's a way that if you don't have a partner with practice, you can do it. You see, the truth of the answer depends on how objective you are. I advise people, don't ask what is your own level of consciousness, because you're never going to get the truth. You'd have to be, a saint to not have any vested interest. It's best to ask your friends, not your friends, somebody else who doesn't know you to do it. Anyway, from the calibrated level of consciousness, you'll see the prevailing emotion. And if you look at the prevailing emotion and the way you view God, etc., you can tell just about where you are. And, you know, if you hate everybody all the time and you're paranoid, you're probably not too much into the heart yet, you know. You visit a city like Chicago or New York City, and you tell me, are the people there friendly or not friendly? How are the people that you met in New York City? If you say, God, they're all wonderful, everybody was friendly and great and wonderful, you know you're about 500 or over. If you say everybody was very horrible, rude, and cold to us, you know that you got a way to go yet. Because the world that you experience is a world of your own projection. See? And, you know, when we go to New York, you can stop anybody on the street, strike up a conversation, it's like your old friends. I can stop any stranger on any street in New York City and start talking about anything, and they'll jabber right back just like we've been buddies for years. And the cab drivers are friendly, the waitress is friendly. It's because you're projecting that. It's because you're projecting that energy, that's why, see? So you can tell by the way people respond to you about where you are, you know? If everybody hates you, then you know you've got a problem. Everybody hates me. I don't know. What can I do?
Is it possible to cross over 600 without becoming ineffectual in the world, namely one's family and job?
Probably not.
Okay. Sorry, Mom. I just read a book on twin souls. It calibrated over 500. Do you believe in that stuff?
I'm not familiar with it, to tell you the truth.
Okay.
I have no trouble with one soul. No, I'm not familiar with the concept. There's many areas of spiritual experience and research and reporting that we haven't had time or energy to do it, you know. If there were two or three of me, we'd do it.
No, it's not. It's like if she is a twin soul to me and we and somehow we're supposed to meet again three lifetimes because there's something left.
I don't know about that. We would. It's an area we haven't looked into.
Okay. And then mm-hmm. I have one other question. It's an acquaintance of mine, and she's a lovely, loving woman. And she talks about, my guide said this, my guide said that, and I always get this little
guides?
Uncomfortable thing.
We didn't get a chance to talk about that today. There's various regions and realms, right? Lower, middle, and upper astral. Huh? The thing with New Ageism and playing around with tarot cards and numerology and divination and things like this, is that you don't know what it is in getting channelings. You don't know what it is you're talking to on the other side. If you can calibrate what's on the other side, then you know what you're dealing with. So much negativity has come out of channeled entities, and you know, we've calibrated many of them. And some of them start out high and then crash, just as many gurus have. So if you know the calibrated energy of Master so-and-so on the other side, I don't advise it. First of all, you have enough difficulty handling it with people in bodies. If it's somebody you can't even see in body, you have no idea what you're dealing with. You have no idea what you're dealing with. And most of them are into control and get their power and gain in the dimension in which they are hanging out by control over humans. So lower astrals are quite eager to possess and control other people. Middle astrals may or may not be integrous. Higher astrals tend to be... there are some really good teachers in the 500s on the other side, and the Bailey books, for instance, Alice Bailey, Ascended White Masters. So I would calibrate the energy of that which you have been dictated and the entity on the other side. There's a lot of masters, I don't want to mention their name here, if you calibrate them, are like 180, 140, 120.
So just check it
out. Yeah. I suggest people not do it, see?
I don't.
If you're interested in enlightenment, then you don't want to diddle around with that which could. Don't forget, the entities on the other side have been there for a long, long time. They are extremely more clever than you are, and they know how to inveigle you and seduce you with their seeming innocence. It's their innocence that is the seduction, and that's the fallen East Indian guru who seduces you with the glamorization and dramatization of that which has been classically associated with divinity, and the purpose is to gain fame, followers, and gain and control over people. And usually they'd establish ashrams where they'd tell you what your sex life should be and start giving you advice on your personal life. No true spiritual teacher gives you any advice on your personal life whatsoever, whether you're married, not married, whether you're celibate, not celibate, whether you eat meat or you don't eat meat. See, a teacher is supposed to help you grow spiritually, in which the answers come to you, because at one point of life it's good to be a vegetarian, another it's ridiculous, you see. As long as you think that life can be killed, then it would be wrong to eat meat. When you realize that it's ridiculous, life cannot be killed, it can only change form. Then it doesn't matter. One day you're sitting there, you've been a vegetarian for 14 years, and suddenly you realize you are meat. Tell me you're above meat. You are meat, idiot, you know. Let's do a little demonstration.
Oh,
yeah, okay. When a moth is flying along and you swat the moth doesn't even notice it, resist. The moth doesn't even notice it. First of all, death is not a possibility. See? He goes right on flying in his etheric body and doesn't really know the difference. He's not attached to physicality like you are. If he's in his etheric body or a physicality, it's all the same to the moth. Yeah. So we didn't mention that like the law of conservation of energy and the law of conservation of matter, there's the law of conservation of life. You cannot kill life at all. you can force it from one form to another form, but you cannot kill life. It's not possible. Because life emanates from the divinity, the reality of divinity. So to say you could kill life would be like saying you can kill God. You can't kill God in any of its expressions. And all of life is an expression of divinity. So how could anything as puny as a human being kill God? You know, so it's a fantasy that you've killed it. The cricket that we asked about this morning, I said, you know, should I put him out of his misery? Thinking of what I did with that guy one time. And because he only had one leg. And it said, no. I said, euthanasia? No. Put him out in the field? Yes. Then I saw I'm projecting my humanness onto the cricket, that for me to only have one leg would be, you know, nothing to eat. He's on the marble floor. No friends. No nature to appreciate. So I'm feeling sorry for this cricket. I'm projecting my humanness onto the cricket. And I asked, does the cricket think this is a problem? No. As far as the cricket's concerned, he just has one leg, so. Life is a cricket. That'd make a whole good book, huh? Life is a one-legged cricket, and how you experience life, and how you experience humans, how funny they are, you know?
In your book, The Eye, you talk about the experiential world of love and God, and it's hard for me to understand it completely, but you talked about a separation, that there are entities that live outside of that.
There are what?
Entities or spirits.
Oh, yeah, so there's
other
dimensions. Yeah.
Other dimensions that are outside.
Yes.
And could you say a little bit more about that? Like, say, would that be like a Hitler that has such karmic debt that he cannot be within the possibility of change in God's...
I really don't know. That's a question beyond my capacity to answer. Mm. But there are different regions. We know the lower, the middle, and the upper astral regions are different. That the celestial realm is different than the lower astral. We know that humans live in this dimension. And I say it's risky enough for humans in this dimension without dabbling with entities from other dimensions who are unseen, unknown, and whose motivations are not clear. Okay, we got to go in.
Transmigration?
Yeah. Huh?
Do you believe in transmigration of the soul through different?
I don't know. I never asked that one. My soul's got enough problems about transmigration, I'll tell you that.
I have two questions, but first, since you're sort of giving calibrations, there's three people I'm sort of interested in: Edgar Cayce, Rudolf Steiner, and then the Seth material.
Yes.
You mentioned Alice Bailey's calibration. Where would you calibrate that material?
Calibrate what?
Cayce.
I don't remember now. We've done it.
Okay. Rudolf Steiner?
Yes, we've done it. They're integrous. They're both integrous. The main question is, are they integrous or not integrous?
Okay.
And then how high is all sort of...
Now to switch gears here, you brought up twice in the lecture that you underwent surgery without anesthesia.
Yes.
Specifically with no local anesthetic or...
No, you just go through surgery because, well, it's like how to heal yourself from an injury. And I always tell people how to do it. And we've demonstrated over and over. Let's say you fall down and you twist your ankle. The way to disappear anything is to let go resisting it. So the first thing you do, also, you can take off weight this way. You can disappear hunger. You can disappear anything. You completely and totally, first of all, stop labeling it. Then you let go resisting the sensation. Nobody can experience hunger. Hunger is a word. It's a concept. Nobody can experience a sprained ankle. Anyway, so you fall down to the ground, and there's this pain coming from your ankle. If you say it's a sprained ankle, you're already giving yourself a sprained ankle. So don't give it any name. There are sensations. You let go resisting these sensations, like the wave. As you let go resisting the sensations, you'll notice that within about a minute, the sensations leave your twisted ankle and now generalize around you. It's like the pain moves from the ankle into the aura. And you let go resisting the sensation. Again, you don't label it anything, you don't call it anything. And if you completely and totally take the third step in AA, or completely and totally surrender resistance to what is, you will disappear the pain. And in about 3 minutes, you walk away healed. If you call it a sprained ankle and resist it, you will end up with a sprained ankle and have your foot in a cast. So the way you disappear a thing is by completely surrendering to it, because you can't experience anything unless you resist it. Yeah.
Okay, we only have about 10 minutes left.
Okay, we'll have to quickly
tangle. And so we are expected somewhere else at the book signing over here at the bookstore. So
there we go.
We're going to have to forego the rest of the questions. I'm sorry. We'll
Where?
Sign books, but we won't have time to answer any more questions
at this
point.
Susan and she'll read them.
And thank you all so
it's,
much.
It's amazing.
We hope you enjoyed this offering from the Shift in Action Partners program and would like to sample more. Partners of the Institute of Noetic Sciences gain access to a weekly stream of inspiration, wisdom, media, and spirited exchange. The program includes live weekly teleseminars with visionaries who are lighting the way forward, Marilyn Schlitz, Dean Radin, Belvie Rooks, Larry Dossey, Candace Pert, Brian Swim, and many more. Our live teleseminars are then added to an extensive archive of audio and video on our website at www.shiftinaction.com, with new offerings each week from teachers like Marianne Williamson, Edgar Mitchell, and Louisa Tisch. The site offers the latest in community-building software that allows you to engage every piece of content as a focal point for education, exchange, and action. Join us in exploring the frontiers of consciousness.